Brooks, Bridewell and Buchan, Boss, Bumper, Bank Holiday, BSB, Bonanza.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 603, and last weekend saw the running of round two of the Bennetts British Superbikes from Alton Park in Cheshire. I had a look ahead, I saw the weather wasn't going to be that bright, so instead of going myself, I sent my friend Dave. Dave, how was it? It didn't look that warm, to be honest.
It was cold, it was miserable, it was grey, it was overcast. It was a typical English spring day, really. Certainly not the weather we had at Silverstone a couple of weeks prior with the 22 degrees and bright sunshine, burnt foreheads and shirt sleeves. It was. We actually had to get the big coat back out.
Yeah, I had. It was pretty windy as well, one or two of the days as well, wasn't it?
It seems to have been windy for the best part of a fortnight in the UK at the minute. Maybe just that time of year, I think, more than anything else. But yeah, it was, and especially the nature of Alton Park circuit with its undulations and Clay Hill, various points of the circuit over the top from Britain's and then down to Knickerbrook. The wind can catch the motorcycles there. It wasn't too much in evidence at Silverstone because it's basically as flat as a pancake, being a former World War II airfield. So, yeah, very, very different set of circumstances over in Cheshire this weekend. Mixed conditions, wet for warm-up on Monday morning. It rained prior to qualifying on Sunday morning as well. So, for the... who else? I can't remember who was out. I think the stock bikes were out, but the super bikes were out at 4 o'clock, so it had dried by then. The support classes had been out and dried the track, and it didn't rain in the afternoon, thankfully. So mixed conditions, mixed bag, bit more what you expect, and more of a true British superbike round, early season British superbike round, more akin to what you'd expect, as we've done before at Donington Park and Silverstone previously. It's often cold, wet, mixed conditions. So it's a bit more like as you were for the start of the season.
Yeah, I thought this was going to be, in some respects, the first true BSB season. Definitely one of those things where I think most people's eyes were probably on Scott Redding to see how he was going to tackle this atypical for a MotoGP rider track.
Yeah, he was... I have a lot of admiration for Scott, and that has increased even more after this weekend, which I'm sure we'll come to. He did come out and admit that the track scared the shit out of him. You know, as you come out of Deer's Leap onto the start finish, you're looking at the pit wall. You're looking through the bubble. The front end's getting light as you come through the crest onto the start finish straight. You're cranked over and you are staring at your pit board ahead of you rather than to your right. So, yeah, and also you have the barriers at each side of Clay Hill. It's just an awful lot tighter than anything he's ever been used to on a bike he's still getting familiar with. But for me, I thought he had a fantastic week. I know we'll talk more about that when we come to the races. But if that's the shape of things to come for Scott Redding on a track that he only had, I think, 18 laps on in the test the week previous, which was, again, in pretty shitty weather. The boy's doing good. We said on the show before that, you know, he is a ridiculous talent on a motorcycle, and that's showing. When you look at the guys that have come previously with Giuliano, Sylvain Gintoli, he's already outperforming anything that they ever did in their first races. So, yeah, chapeau to Scott Redding.
It was a real reminder watching those bikes go around the first few practice, you know, and just the undulations, the bumps, the way the bikes are moving. That even for me, that was like, oh yeah, that's right, that's what it's like. I'm trying to imagine what that must have been like for Scott Redding, and you know, to take that on. As he, it was one thing to go around and know which way the track goes. I think it's something else to see the pace, especially his teammate was attacking that track from the get-go.
Yeah, that's the whole point of Scott Redding being in BSB, that he now appreciates the pace in which the British Superbike boys can run at circuits like Alton Park and Cadwell, those two parkland circuits. I think he has a newfound admiration for it, certainly for his teammate and for the guys around him, that they can lap that track at that pace. because they have the experience. Some of the guys have grown up on the circuit. You likes of Lee Jackson, who've done Superstock on, sorry, Lee Jackson. Christian Iden has had many, many races around there. Josh Brooks has. Danny Buchan, that's better, has had many a Superstock race around there. So, yeah, the guys around him have done countless laps around Cheshire. The leafy, undulating Cheshire circuit, as we got into. It's a cliche of cliches for Alton Park. Almost every press release ever written has the word leafy and undulating in it. So why not throw it into Motorpod this week as well, eh?
Well, but just before we want to move on, I have a bit of a bone to pick with you, if you don't mind. It's been brought to my attention, and I was upset that I had to find out about this over social media, but it sounds like you've been seeing someone else behind my back. Is there something you want to tell me, Dave?
What, my little adventure at the weekend with the good Lord Greg Haynes?
I heard you were double dating. I couldn't believe it. I turn on the TV and I hear your dulcet tones with one Mr. Gregory Haynes, no
indeed,
less.
Indeed, indeed. I kept it as low under the radar as I possibly could, due to the fact that if I made a Herculean dog's body of it all, then nobody
would
really notice.
Which was always a possibility.
Well, thank you. Far too kind. Far too kind. For the listeners that don't know, I was chatting to Greg Haynes in the week, the esteemed Eurosport commentator for World Superbikes and the British Superbike support classes.
And there was also a rumour a large envelope stuffed full of cash crossed the table.
There is no, my bank account still reads the same miserable figure that it did before the weekend, if not slightly less. I'd basically been in touch. We'd had Steve English on at Silverstone, and I knew Greg was going to be at Alton Park. So I dropped Greg a message and said, look, would you come on the podcast? Here's a link. This is what it sounds like. This is what we do. And he said, yep, not a problem, Dave. Absolutely fine. I'll have a listen as well. I said, good. As a media professional, you know, let me know what you think. It's good to get some feedback from somebody who's never listened to the podcast before. And if I can improve on anything, then go ahead, let me know. And he came back with, actually, I've got a bit of a proposition for you. Neil McKenzie was in Jerez on Sunday for the Red Bull Rookies Series, which left an opening to cover the Hell Performance British Motorstar race, the first race of the season for those boys, on Sunday afternoon. And he said, would you sit in and join with me? So, of course, without hesitation, I said, yes, I'd absolutely love to. Not something I've ever considered before, commentary or anything like that. We know our own Harry Lloyd has been in the commentary booth previously for World Superbikes with Dorna. But it was never something that I thought I could do or was smart enough or knowledgeable enough, let's say, to do something like that. So on the Friday, after I'd agreed on the Friday, I spent 4 hours compiling notes for the Motostar field. Numerous WhatsApp voice messages with Greg and getting things lined up and ready. Nervous energy abound. I was really, as Jennifer will tell you, there isn't an awful lot in the British Superbike paddock that actually really excites me these days. Don't get me wrong, I love being there and it is my happy place without a shadow of a doubt outside of Jen's place in Barrow Ford. From a solely a personal point of view and a sporting point of view, there is no place I would rather be. But having the experiences that we've had in the paddock, I can take most things in my stride. But this really did flick a switch. And as some of you guys have seen on social media already, I posted the picture after the event. And you unfortunately got to listen to it as well.
I have to say, I thought it went rather well.
Thank you.
I mean, I think I texted you at the time, a duck to water.
You did indeed.
I mean, doubtless, I knew you'd do your homework and it sounded like you had done your homework, but it just was so fluid and everything. And I sat and thoroughly enjoyed the Motorstar racing, watching a fistful of hooligans actually hurl themselves around a track. It is great racing, and it's a good reminder that you know, some of these smaller series can throw up some really, really exciting racing.
They can, and the British Superbike races weren't the most thrilling this weekend.
I mean, it was an interesting race intellectually, but it wasn't sort of seat the pants thrilling.
No, it wasn't. The Stock 1000 race was okay. The Supersport race was fairly okay, but the two Motostar races were really good, and having the chance to talk to our American listeners, if our esteemed American listeners do listen to the British Superbike arm of Motopod these days. Young Brandon Pash, who was fifth at last month's Daytona 200. I know Brandon anyway through various other means, and had a bit of a chat with him on the Saturday afternoon and got him to write me a track map. So, Brandon, what gear are you in here? What speeds are you doing there? And what's your favourite parts of the track? Just so I could have an understanding of a rider's point of view, because I was the colour commentator, if you like. Greg Haynes is always the lead commentator, and I just throw little bits in as and when I can, things that I see, little bits of information that I can drop in while Greg takes a breath. And it was great to sit down with Brandon, and we had sort of 10 minutes with him afterwards for Motopod, which you guys will hear later on. And he's a talent. If you see on Brandon's social media, he's really such a big talent. And also, young Dan Jones, the young Welshman who's been away doing Red Bull Rookies, chat with Dan. I know his dad, Steve. And it dovetailed quite nicely, because there are a few guys in that class who I know, or I know their parents, or I know the team, just through being around the paddock for a few years. Josh Watley, we featured him and his sister Safi on Paddock Chatter maybe 5 years ago, when Josh was sort of 7 or 8 and he was doing mini GP racing, things like that. That kid's been around for what seems like just 20 years. It's not, it's 5, but time passes so quickly. He's only just 13 now, and he's running in the GP class at Motostar. So, you know, when you look at the guys that series has thrown out, the likes of Taron McKenzie and Bradley Ray, people like that, Tom Booth Amos, Jake Archer, it's a real good grounding for future riders. So with Emily's input as well, who's friends with a lot of these guys platonically, it all works. It was the perfect race series for me to come in and just sit and talk with Greg. Greg doesn't know any of the riders at all. Hardly, because he comes in and he says what he sees. But I could bring a little bit more to it. I took him down to see Brandon and meet his crew chief Dave Swan, and it was a bigger experience for Greg, rather than Neil just coming in through the front door into the commentary booth and going out again. We had a little bit of time to spend together on this when I was sort of going behind your back, obviously, which I'm hugely unremorseful for, because you weren't around. If you can't give me the time, then I'm just gonna have to seek solace elsewhere, Andy. So it was a fantastic experience. It's one that I won't forget. If it gets repeated, if I get chance to do it again, then all well and good. But I'm just taking it as a one-off. Steve English, I have to give it a tip of the hat to Steve. You know how there are no secrets in motorcycle racing, right?
Well, not for very long, that's true.
Not for very long. So all of a sudden, I text Harry, as one of my closest friends in racing, and I said, I've got a bit of a gig on Sunday, and I'm doing Motostar. He went, brilliant, congratulations, good luck, I'll try and listen. I'm like, mate, you're going to be busy, because the race goes out while you're celebrating a race win, hopefully. And then sort of a day or two later, I get a message from Steve English. I hear you're going to be busy on Sunday. I'm like, right, okay, so I know who told you. And they have a group chat with one or two others, and then I'm at the circuit on Saturday, and Ollie Rushby, the former NCN reporter and now PR man for McCams Yamaha, goes, doing something tomorrow, are we? And you're like, okay, this is fine. But tip of the hat to Steve English. He gave me some real good pointers to go and see a rider, go and get a track map, go and do this, talk to the tyre guys. Things that I had thought about, but he reinforced that you need that information. You might not use it. And the 4 hours of notes that I put together, 4.5 hours, whatever it was, sounds a lot, but if I do it again, it'll only be maybe an hour or so because I have the bulk of the information that I need. So it sounds a lot for one race because it was the first one of the season. So it was collating the information that I needed. And because the races were so good, I didn't really need my notes anyway. So we had a good time. Greg was happy. The Eurosport guys were happy. It was nice to be in there with Jim Witt, Matt Roberts, Rachel Stringer, who were all really, really helpful, really kind, and trying to relax me. It was only a little 15-minute race, but it was such a massive occasion for me. And Jennifer was in there as well, so she's recorded me from that end. I still haven't seen it back on the TV yet, so I don't know what it was like on the broadcast. I'm keen to see that, obviously, to see where I can improve and what I can do. But let's see, you know, if the opportunity comes again, then I'll seize it with both hands. If it doesn't, then it was a fantastic experience. And thank you for your kind words as well, mate, while I was there. It was hugely appreciated.
Yeah, like I say, once I got over the initial shock and everything and went through the box of tissues and everything.
I wasn't like that I say, good.
Absolutely seamless. And in fact, I personally would have preferred a little more you and sort of the colour commentary than a little less Greg. So I think
it's my
maybe,
first time. It's
understand. I think, you know, maybe if you do, and I hope you do get the opportunity to do a second time as well, Greg will, you know, trust that, you know, you're not going to leave empty air and you do have a lot to add because, I learned a lot from that too. And I think I'm going to might add some of the more Motorstar races to my regular programming. It's nice to know, at least from Eurosport standpoint, that all of that gets taped as well. So it is available on, you know, their sort of rerun after the event.
Yeah, it's available. The race is still available, I think, on the Eurosport player. So once I get the copy of that, I'll be intrigued to see how it went. I don't remember how the race went. I remember Dan Jones launching it at the first corner. At the first hairpin at Shell Oils. And that was about it. But one thing that caught Greg was he looked at me, he said, you were disappointed, but you weren't surprised. Why? I said, because I knew that's what he was going to do. I had a sense that that's what Dan was going to do. He'd made the break. He'd been on the left side of the tyre for so long. He goes into the Shell Oils right-hander onto the colder right-hand side of the tyre, gave it a fistful of gas and was launched straight out the top window.
And so I can't even remember if they had tyre warmers on the grid. I don't think they did.
Yeah, they do. They have tyre warmers on the grid. Oh, certainly okay. They do. Yeah, absolutely.
But still, that first lap is going to be cold on, like you say, that side of the tyre. So
it is because you're on the left side for yeah. sort of a third of the lap before you get to Shell Oils. And he did it kind of just as soon as he tapped the gas, it let go.
Yeah. Just one of those, unfortunately, I think adults call it experience.
It's that, yeah. I spoke to him after.
It's like learning the lessons, unfortunately.
It is. I'd spoke to him afterwards, and he was under orders not to do that. And, you know, sometimes trying to tell a 16-year-old kid what to do, and he's like, nah, fuck off, I know better. Yeah, well, you don't really, do you? And then
psychology thing. They don't have to employ 16-year-old reverse psychology.
Yeah, if ever that's going to happen in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, and then, but he did learn from it, and he was sore, and it was good to go down and talk to the guys after the race. I'd been to see them before and saying, look, I'm commentating on your race. Nice to meet you. Again, Dan was another one that we'd featured on Paddock Chatter a few years ago when he was racing the 250 Morawaki. So his dad and I had a rapport anyway. They were really happy that I was doing the commentary on it. So it all worked out well. And Scott Swan, who had a great race on the Monday, Motostar is a really, really good class. We're not going to have, unlike last year and the year before, where Ryan Saxelby's City lifting squad literally disappeared over the horizon with Tom Booth Amos in 2017 and Jake Archer last year, ably assisted by Jack Scott. So I think it's going to be an awful lot more competitive this year with like Jack Nixon and Asher Durham and Brandon and Dan Jones, Scott Swan. You know, they're going to be the main protagonists. They're all going to have their day. But these machines, you know, with you'll hear from, I think Brandon mentioned it in his interview. I can't remember if we did or not. The bike that Brandon is on is a former Jaume Massia Andrea Mino Platinum Bay real estate machine from last year.
Mm-hmm.
So they are full
yeah.
they are full GP machines. Absolutely. Yeah, they are all XGP machines. So they're on good, good quality kit. And then you get into rider weight. And it was really good to delve into that side of things. And something that I really would love to do more of, but whether I get the chance to do it or not, I don't know. But it's a British paddock. I know it well.
Yeah. Well, like I say, fingers crossed. And the other thing too, I was happy that through that experience and contact, it's an opportunity for us here on Motopod as well to just do a little bit more promotion and discussion of some of the other supporting classes and help the listeners, you know, start to get the names of some of these up and coming riders that they are likely to see either moving across into through CEV or into MotoGP, Moto3. Continuing through the British BSB rounds up through Supersport into Superstock and maybe into Superbike.
Yeah, 100% that's the way to look at it. Storm Stacey was with Brandon Pasha's team last year, and he's now on the Stock 600 Stauf Connect Academy bike, so he's already made that next step. Jake Archer's on a GP2 machine alongside Kyle Ride in Supersport. So there's definitely a career progression. Not everybody's going to make it to CEV. Tom Booth Amos found it really difficult. Charlie Nesbitt found it really difficult. He came back and is now in Supersport. Talented kid. But then that CEV level is just another step. And unfortunately, that's going to be beyond some riders. You're always going to find your level somewhere. Some will find their level at MotoGP. Some will find their level at Stock 6. Some will find their level at British Superbikes. It's just the nature of racing, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, I think too, CEV now has become such a crucial stepping stone. It also means too that talent just isn't necessarily enough. I've heard some big numbers discussed that need to accompany riders to get rides and help finance them through a season. And I think that is equally part of a challenge these days too.
It really is. Yeah, I've heard figures quoted well into six figures. For rides in Moto3 on a not a particularly competitive ride. So, yeah, it's a difficult time. Do you stay in the UK and make your name there and go down the production route, or do you try and lump everything into a GP career and go all out for Sev and possibly end up with next to nothing? So, no, the guys that have been out there have nearly almost all come back, which is a massive shame. Jamie Davis, Josh Watley, Charlie Nesbitt, the guys that have all tried their hand out in Sev are back in the UK at the moment. Not to say they're not going to go back again, but at this point in time, they're all congregating in the British Superbike paddock, as well as the guys that are doing BTC, which the likes of Jack Nixon, Scott Swan, Scott Ogden, guys like that, are using that as a springboard, if there is a springboard this year. Max Cook is going on fabulously well. I think he's doing European Talent Cup and Red Bull Rookies. So as one of the talents from last year, he really is pushing as hard as he can. So, yeah, the opportunities are out there. But for this season, let's see how that series pans out. But we'll be keeping an eye on it, especially for our American listeners as well. Brandon Pasha, super talented kid. And then obviously with the Welshman, Dan Jones, they're going to be the main two, I think, for this year.
Well, let's move on and talk about the headline main event that ran over the weekend, which was the Superbikes. I think it was pretty clear from the free practice and then into qualifying, there was one man and he was on a mission to pay back, I guess, the poor result from Silverstone.
He certainly was, and he was fastest at the test the previous week as well. PBM Beweiser Ducati's Josh Brooks really had his bit between the teeth this weekend and was keen to make amends for what was essentially a triple non-finish after not finishing in qualifying and DNFing in both the Superbike races down in Northamptonshire. So, yeah, he was very, very keen to make amends. And for some, I don't know what's clicked, but something definitely clicked between that Panigale V4R and the Alton Park circuit as he was ably backed up by his teammate to the ability that he could do at this Alton Park round, but also for the Oxford Products Moto Rapido Ducati of Tommy Bridewell.
Yeah, he was consistently strong as well. Some people were starting to theorize, like, is this the wings on the Ducati that's helping to control the wheelies around this undulating and bumpy circuit?
Bridewell was convinced.
Yeah, I think we'd seen, Bridewell had really hooked up with that Ducati before. And I think, you know, he felt it was going to go well. And, you know, he pushed Josh Brooks like pretty much all the way through the entire weekend. I think we saw that in qualifying as well.
Certainly did. If anywhere, any track in the UK is going to benefit from winglets on a motorcycle, it's Alton Park. You have the crest over the rise between Britain Chicane and down to Hizzy's. You have the rise over Clay Hill. You have the rollers down the back from Druids down to Lodge Corner. So there are multiple opportunities for the winglets to really kick in with what they need to be doing. And especially, obviously, BSB runs the Motec ECU, which has no rider aids whatsoever, no traction control, no anti-wheelie. It's all done with the right wrist, so any little additions that can help the rider, then it's going to work really well, especially around there with the changes in elevation and the ribbon of tarmac that is Alton Park. One of my favorite circuits in the UK, I have to say.
And one of the other people I saw strong in the timesheets and doing well in qualifying as well was the Peter Hickman on the BMW. The BMW that we knew they'd only had a very, very short time to work with. Something we still feel that maybe the engine isn't up to full power, but that's something that necessarily isn't a prerequisite for doing well at Alton Park.
Definitely not. No. The nature of there aren't many straights, if any, at Alton Park. So outright top speed, outright horsepower isn't much of an issue. They are still running a stock engine, or a less than stock engine, on the BMWs at the moment until, as we've discussed previously, they can marry up the variable valve time into the Motec ECU.
And but I did find out one extra little bit of detail about
that.
I thought maybe they had just pulled out the stock cam and just chucked in some sort of race cam. But I don't know if it's rules they need to run the stock cam, but they basically just locked it in the high rev position.
Yep, that's exactly what they did. But what Hickey was saying over the weekend is that the chassis is so, so sweet. Having ridden various, and Christian Idden backed him up on this as well, having ridden the different variants over the last few years of the BMW S1000RR, the chassis on this new one, which really has come into its own at Alton Park, not something you can really spot at Silverstone, which is essentially a triangle of four corners and three straights. So it didn't really come into its own there. But here, where higher corner speeds and agility will give you a faster lap time than out-and-out horsepower, this really came to the fore with three BMWs making it through to Q3, which I thought was a fantastic achievement for the German mark.
Keith Farmer as well, obviously gelling well with the BMW alongside his teammate Christian Idden.
Yeah, I was surprised by Keith because he doesn't have the smoothest of riding styles. He is a grip it and rip it man. He always has been. That's his style. That's how he rides a motorcycle. Everybody's different. Everybody has their own style. Some are smooth, and you have Michael Laverty that's as smooth as silk. But Keith Farmer, supermoto background. He's not afraid to move around on the bike and force it to do what he wants it to do. And Alton Park, I think he shone this weekend. A lot of people were saying over the winter that he doesn't really ride a superbike too well, and he can't do this, he can't do that. But to muscle a superbike around Alton Park after being off one for so long, to then put it into Q3 and qualifying, I think that's a great result for Keith.
Yeah, agreed. I think in the final Q3, he was only 0.2 behind Christian Idden on the same bike.
Absolutely, and Christian's had, what, 3-4 seasons on it now?
Yeah,
Of differing variants, but on a superbike.
And sandwiched between them was Scott Redding in 7th, and I'm sure he was over the moon to make it into Q3.
He was, because, again, setting off before before the weekend started, he didn't have the highest of aims for the weekend to come away with a decent result. And I thought, really, if he could when you sit and look at the pre-race preamble, you look at the riders that you think may do well, and Silverstone was a bit of an anomaly, so we'll look at that as its own individual entity. But then you come into the real nuts and bolts of British circuits, which is Alton Park, and you think, you know, if that boy can get top five on a circuit he's only done 18 laps on a superbike that he's still getting used to riding, on electronics that he's not quite used to, then that would be a measure of the man. And I think that's an early warning shot for the rest of the season, you know?
Yeah, I saw that, and I saw how well Josh Buchs was going, and I was starting to think that this year could shape up essentially for the top two positions, an all-out war between Brooks and Redding.
For me, that's going to come, no doubt at all. Yeah. At a track that they both know that they both get dialed in for, that's going to come at some point this season. I don't know when, but you know, I think, to be fair, I think next time out at Donington Park, it's the first circuit that Scott Redding knows well in full, rather than the I know it's the national layout, so we miss out the Melbourne Loop. But rather than it's still only going to be like a 1 minute two, 1 minute three lap, but it's better than the 53-second lap, 54-second lap that Silverstone was.
So, and it's something he can attack.
It is, yeah, it
instantly,
is.
Instantly, I think, rather than Alton, where I think you need to ease your way into it.
Agreed. Yeah, he can hit the ground running there without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, you know, he podiumed in the second race at Silverstone, so, you know, that proved his worth on a track that he knows. And if he can hit fifth on a track that he doesn't know, seventh in qualifying on a track that he doesn't know, in conditions that weren't particularly ideal, windy and cold and horrible, then yeah, he's quietly going about his business, and he isn't going to be far away, I don't think, at any race meet. If he can do that this weekend, he isn't going to be far away at all.
I want to touch in a minute on just a few people who maybe we think lost out a little bit in qualifying. But I did want to mention another person who I thought had a standout qualifying, and ultimately I think a pretty solid event, and that's Ryan Vickers.
I disagree.
Do you think? I'm
not
disappointed?
Impressed.
Yeah. You're not impressed at all?
No, massively unimpressed.
Ah,
because
I'm looking at this kid thinking, like, this is a kid who gets ID'd if he tries to buy wine gums.
No, because it was his last flying lap that pushed Josh out of Q3.
Well, there's a farmer as well. I mean, farmer.
Ryan Vickers is a talent.
I thought, well, it was like Farmer who pushed Tara McKenzie out, but it was Ryan who pushed out Josh, was it?
Farmer pushed Tara McKenzie out, Hickey pushed Luke Mossy out, and then Ryan Vickers pushed Josh out.
Okay, so you're giving him daggers.
Absolutely. One of my good friends, Del Rhodes, he's basically team technical coordinator for Lee Hardy, RAF regular and reserves Kawasaki. I do like to try and get the full team names in, because I think it's the right thing to do.
Agreed.
As much as sometimes I don't trip off the tongue too well. Talking to Del over the last couple of months, the kid's the real deal. There's absolutely no doubt about it. It's fascinating to see him progress. And although he wasn't particularly in the window at Silverstone, to come to Alton Park and make it through into Q3 as a raw rookie, I think is a fantastic achievement. And there's an awful lot of eyes on this kid. And for me, he has a massively, massively bright future. All joking aside about Q3 and for Josh, yeah, I'm only messing about. He is a super, super talent. And one we really do need to keep a close eye on across the season. He's looked after by former 250 GP winner Alan Carter, who won, he was the youngest 250 GP winner, I think, in 84, riding the Marlboro Yamaha at Le Mans. So Alan's got a fantastic pedigree. Roger Burnett is looking after his affairs from a sponsorship perspective. So he has a really close-knit team around him. BSB are making sure he has everything he needs. Because it's fairly unprecedented for a young rider to go straight from Stock 6 to British Superbike. I know we had our chats about it before, and it's like, well, will he be okay? But these things bite, and I still think there's a point where the superbike will bite him, and it'll bite him hard. I think that's just the nature of the sport without the traction control. But you know, he's a gifted little rider. There might come a chance if he does get really confident and he's really settled with it and he starts to push a little bit harder. It's just pushing that envelope bit by bit. It's the age old cliche of, you know, you see it on press releases and in newspaper columns. You know, we're chipping away. We're chipping away bit by bit. We're making steps forward across motorcycle racing. But they really are. They have a plan. They're sticking to the plan. There might come a point where he gets a little bit excited and something happens, but it's not necessarily definitely going to happen. The kid's a joy to watch.
Yeah,
agree. Sorry, I thought you'd fallen asleep.
No. I completely agree. But I was just had said like that was the only person. But I also wanted to just give a quick shout out to Dean Harrison.
Yes,
as well, the road racer there in 15th. Not unusual to see road racers doing some short circuit racing to sharpen up the sort. Short circuit racing skills ahead of the road season starting, and I thought he did well, and I think he also went on to have a pretty good event. But let's touch on some of like the people, I guess, who maybe had less than stellar events. Glenn Irwin.
Where do you want to start? That's the best place to start, I think. What a dreadful weekend.
I mean, to be fair, I mean, there were, you know, Danny Buchan, I think, was in sixth on it, the top Kawasaki. We mentioned Ryan Vickers in ninth. As well. So you could argue that maybe this was not a track for the Kawasaki's, but we know the quality of the team. We know the quality of the staff and the preparation they put. This was the championship winning team last year. I think they and Glenn himself would have expected a little bit better than 24th on the grid.
Without a shadow of a doubt. You know, his Q1 time, 137.2. Versus Ryan Vickers 135.9 and Danny Buchan at a 135.3. That's, you know, 1.9 seconds. That's a gap or a gulf that even Moses couldn't close. You know, there's an awful lot going on with Glenn Irwin at the moment. That conversion from riding a V-twin to riding a Kawasaki. Four-cylinder Kawasaki is taking a lot longer than he would have liked, a lot longer than the team would have liked. That pressure's starting to show on him. He's just not gelling with it at all. Unfortunately, we couldn't do it this weekend, but the measure for Glenn is his teammate, Ben Curry. But unfortunately for Ben, his weekend was cut short through injury. After he high-sided at Shell Oils on Saturday. So there wasn't really a marker for Glenn within the team. But talking to guys in the team, it's frustrating for everybody involved. It's really hard for the team after last year where they had no DNFs all the way through the season with Leon Haslam. And now that they're not getting where they need to be. They had DNFs at Silverstone for both riders. They didn't even make it through Q1. And the team stroke rider just ended up not lurching from one disaster to another. But it's just not working. I think Glenn's made some change, or the team have made some changes. I believe his crew chief left the team on Saturday night. I think that was Simon Lane, I think. And also Jeremy Williams was there trying to help Glenn adapt and trying to help him with his lines and doing a bit of spotting. I think he was certainly at Silverstone and he was there this weekend, but I think also he's been let go now. I stand corrected on that, but I think that's what I gleaned over the weekend. So try to get things right for Glenn. It will click. There's no doubt about it. It will click and he will be fast. But I think it's just messing with his head a little bit. Excuse me. It's messing with his head a little bit at the moment. Because if you're just even slightly off the pace in British Superbikes, it shows massively. because everybody else, it's such a competitive series that you only need to be half a second off the pace and you're well down the timesheets.
And I think sometimes because it is so competitive, in actual fact, this is where having a second strong teammate, a strong rider in the team can help. I think sometimes if you're starting to lose your way a little bit with setup and feeling, having someone who's about the same pace as you either confirm or, you know, help you find a new direction can help move the team together. And I think sometimes, you know, we've seen in the past riders who are sort of on their own pace wise.
Yes.
Can struggle a little bit because they've only got like half the data of some of the competing teams to work with over what is a fairly short window, just a couple of free practice before you even hit qualifying.
It is. It's hard to compare notes when one rider's, you know, a second off the other one. But with the nature of the riders in BSB, that's not often going to be the case. You're always going to have one senior rider and one junior rider. PBM have been very fortunate in having Josh Brooks and Scott Redding. Peter Hickman, James Ellison at Smith's, two contrasting weekends you couldn't find.
Ellison has been completely, I mean, I think at Silverstone and this weekend too, just anonymous in some respects on, you know, on a BMW that Peter Hickman is taking to third. They're different riders. They're going to have different tracks. But James, for some reason, is really struggling with the beginning of this year.
He really is. I mean, Hickey will ride through anything. Hickey will ride through brick walls if he has to. He can, when you do the TT and you do the roads, your bike will never be 100% perfect. So you have to ride through issues. You have to ride through vibrations. You have to ride through the mental stresses of what's that? That's not right. It's not turning. You just have to force it to do it because you don't have any option. Whereas James is a dyed-in-the-wool track rider and is well known for needing things to be a certain way. Almost in a Jorge Lorenzo sense, that the bike has to be set a certain way. He has to be a certain level of comfort on the bike, the bike to behave in a certain way. And a lot of times on British circuits, you're not going to get that. You've got to be able you've got to have the desire and the drive to ride through problems. You ride the fast groups on track days. Your bike's never going to be perfect. You just ride through it. You know, because otherwise, oh, I don't like this, I don't like that, it's not going to work. Hickey's is, for want of a better phrase, he's making a mockery of James Ellison at the moment. I would love to see James back up there. There are, I'm told, things going on in the background as well, which are maybe distracting him as well. But really, you know, work's work, and he really has to step up, do what he can, and at least he should be top end of Q2. I don't expect him to be in Q1 on a regular Q3, on a regular basis, but I'd love to see him up there into Q2 and sort of on the fringes of Q1, because you know, the guy can ride a bike, but the last sort of 12 months have really been a terrible time for James Ellison.
I think really that kind of like rounds up class, you know, the qualifying. Shall we just get on to the races?
Go for it.
So race one, I mean, I think really race one was really just about Josh Brooks and just watching him and Tommy Bridewell. And a fairly, like, you know, in the early days, I think it were, you know, we could see that one or two of the old ones can make the running to try and stay with him. But I mean, Josh Brooks just had a different pace, you know, right from the get go. And he was just able to just lap after lap, just sneak away. And the only person ultimately that was able to stay even vaguely close to him was Tommy Bridewell on the other Ducati.
Yeah, before the start of the weekend, I think there was nobody going to bet against Josh Brooks for the double this weekend. I think probably only Tommy Bridewell had a bit of a twinkle in his eye that might, you know, that I can give him a run for his money here. And I thought Tommy rode a fantastic race to bring the bike home. He's matured as a rider. He's matured in his outlook. I think that was a fantastic race. He showed towards the back end of last year his comfort with the Moto Rapido squad. It's basically his calling. He's been in teams before. He hasn't. It's been almost a square peg in a round hole to try and fit Tommy into the team or the team around Tommy. He hasn't been this settled since the old supersonic days. So it's good to see Tommy up there. Danny Buchan has been a revelation for the start of the season as well.
Interest- that was a strong ride, actually.
It really was. You know, it proves that Silverstone was no fluke. He had two very different circuits, yet he's still getting the results. And we kind of saw flashes of it last year up towards Cadswell before he launched his bike at the Med Centre into the catch fencing, which really kept him out of a top six showdown shot because he had that that slim chance of making it into the final six for the FS3 Kawasaki team. So, yeah, it's a good, strong start for Danny Buchan. He's starting to rack up the podium positions as well, the podium points as well. Jason O'Halloran, interesting news coming out after the weekend about Jason O'Halloran. Have you read that?
It turned out he was riding with a broken arm.
He's got a fractured right humerus, which happened at the test the previous Thursday. He had a small off at the test, very low speed. It was a nothing crash, but it was a reasonably, I think, heavy landing. Even though it was a slow speed, he took a bit of a knock to his shoulder, which kept him out the rest of the set of the day. And he's had physio and the usual treatment, whether it be heat treatment, laser treatment, whatever he can do to get things healing quicker in the 2 weeks. In the week between the test and the opening session. But yeah, it came out on the McCams Yamaha social media feed after the race that he'd been racing all weekend with a fractured with a chipped humerus. And so this guy is the most unlucky racer in British Superbike. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think they even mentioned that in the commentary sometime. You know, from that expression, if he didn't have bad luck, he wouldn't have any luck at all.
If he fell in a barrel of tits, he'd still come out sucking his thumb.
Exactly. And, you know, there's always this sense of like, you know, he'll have a bad weekend. I mean, look at it, the opening round at Silverstone. And then there's this sense like, well, you know, the silver lining is like, at least it's all done now. You know, how can you have any more bad luck?
Yeah.
So, you know, you got it done for the season. It's over and done with, you know, onwards and upwards.
Ta-da! And have some
it
more.
It just seems to be something else that they haven't thought of. I mean, yeah.
It's a difficult time, but, you know, you're looking at difficult times. Glenn Irwin DNF'd in the race. Christian Iden DNF'd in the race. He pulled in with a fueling issue. Luke Mossy cracked an exhaust. Poor old Joe Francis, after, by his standards, a stellar performance in qualifying at his local Cheshire circuit. I spoke to him on Sunday morning and said, what do you reckon for this afternoon? What do you want to do? He said, I just want to progress on times. He said, I just want his ideal was to get into the 36s. You know, he was running 38, so I want to go 37. I want to get into the 36s. That's my target on a superbike. And he did a 36.3 and a 36.9 in qualifying. So he was as
and
happy.
The race is just track time, even if it's nothing else.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
For an event, it's like, you know, it's just, 20 laps of full-on pace, just seeing what you can do, you know, learning about the tyre.
It is, it's bumming seat time, isn't it?
Track time with a bike. Yeah, yeah, it
fuel
really
loads,
is.
Decreasing
so,
fuel
you
loads.
Know, and sometimes people might think, oh, what, you know, why do people run around at the back? Because it's really good, beneficial.
Of course
time.
It is. Yeah, and it was a shame for Joe because morning warm-up was wet as we got to the circuit. There's a heavy rain shower passed over the circuit. Scott Redding, he crashed coming. He had a bit of a high side coming out of Knickerbrook chicane.
It's a nasty one as well.
It was quite slow,
wasn't
it?
It took him a while. So, he actually had to crawl off of the track. I think he's still nursing that, the recovery from the broken leg.
And the ankle ligaments or something that was done before that as well. He's been injured more than once in the off season, and they've kept a massive lid on it. Because he said in an interview afterwards that it was his femur and his, it might have been his knee ligaments or something else that he'd done.
I think it was tib and fib, they
prior
said,
to that. So, you know, he's been in the wars over the winter, which makes this season, the start to this season, even more impressive. But unfortunately, Joe went down on the entry to Hizzy Chicane, relatively uninjured for him, sort of took the wind out of his sails a little bit. Well, unfortunately, the bike dug in and went end over end. So, unfortunately, the Lloyd and Jones Boca Motorrad BMW team had to basically rebuild Joe's bike unfortunately, they managed to rebuild it, but on the warm-up lap, I don't know, it was an oil pipe came loose. Something came loose on the bike and put fluid down, which I think was oil, that Keith Farmer had spotted on, because Keith is traditionally the last man round the track. It doesn't matter where his start position is, he's the last man round the track. And I think he alerted the safety car to the fact that Joe's bike was dropping fluid.
Yeah, exactly. I think he, like you say, he slipped back and just pulled up alongside the safety car.
Yeah.
To explain what he'd seen,
which was good of him, and it, you know, it shows how aware these guys are of what's going on around them, which curtailed Joe's race at his home circuit, which is a big shame after the strides he'd made during qualifying. But yeah, James Ellison, he's down there. James Hillier, Luke Stapleford. Difficult weekend for him after a crash in free practice that damaged his wrist. Difficult. When you look down it, there's an awful lot of backstories to British Superbikes at the start of the season.
Yeah, I was just looking at Chavy Forrest as well and the Honda.
Yeah, you know, he'll come to the fore eventually. It's a difficult circuit to dial a bike into and to get your head around. But nobody was going to touch Josh Brooks, not at all. Tommy Bridewell. Stayed on his coattails, but rode a really mature race to finish in second place. And then Danny Buchan ploughing his way through to third place was really impressive. There's a lot of people sort of raising their eyebrows at Danny Buchan this year in the best way possible. So long may that continue for him. Jason O'Halloran salvaged a finish in fourth place, and Scott Redding a decent fifth. And Hickey in sixth is a really good result, being the first BMW home ahead of Keith Farmer.
Yeah,
by 5 seconds.
Yeah, well, he and Hickman as well had a terrible start. He really had to battle to make up those spots.
He did, but not as much as he had to battle in race two.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Smooth segue.
Yeah, so race two, that, I mean, we were expecting everyone to get underway, but even before they did got to do the warm-up lap, I think, they came up to Peter Hickman and pulled him off of the grid for failing a random tyre pressure test.
Yes, I've been listening to the Eurosport podcast this afternoon. The Shaky Show with Greg Haynes.
Yeah, that got gate crashed by Stuart Hicks.
It did indeed. And Stuart had a very articulate and informative view of the tyre pressure story. And
I should just wanted to say too, because I think Shaky was there and just saying to Stuart, saying, hey, look, you know, that's a pretty big punishment to be pulled off of the grid and have to essentially start from pit lane. For what was, I think, like, you know, a tyre that was just fractionally under. And I think this is essentially Stuart Higgs giving his reply to that.
And he did it really well. And his point was that we can't be fanning around on the grid with 3 minutes to go, putting air in the tyre. The best place and safest place to do that is pit lane. So the bikes will be taken off the grid and you will start from the back of the grid. Racing is racing, and this isn't anything directed at the teams in BSB. This is purely an overview of racing in general. And it happens in GP, it happens in World Superbikes, it happens in BSB. And I'm not at any point saying that this is the reason that Hickey or Claudio Corti were taken off the grid. Is that a decent enough disclaimer?
Yeah, I think we already know from other series that Pirelli and other tyre manufacturers have had issues with teams running or suspecting that teams are running under pressure tyres. These rules have come in to other series.
Yes.
Clearly, they're going to be adapted.
Of course.
By British Superbikes. You know, the whole protocol is laid out in the rules. And as a team, you also know, too, if you decide to run it close to the limit but get caught, either intentionally or not,
yes,
what the punishment, or at least, you know, what the solution is going to be.
Yeah.
So in my mind, you know, if you look at that and thinking, you know what, we don't want to run the risk. There's, you know, there's one thing that we might get docked a point or added 2 seconds to a lap time or something for an infringement. But it just it seemed to me that either they need some extra all the teams, you know, need to manage this.
They do.
As part of the checklist, as when they get the, you know, the bike and the rider to the grid. And they just need to leave a little bit of margin. Unfortunately, Peter got stung by that. And from my sense, his sort of reaction after the race, I don't think he had any issue with that at all. The rule was a rule. It was treated and unfair.
Absolutely that. And
I almost got the sense he enjoyed the race, you know, fighting his way back from the back of the grid.
It captured his attention, didn't it?
Definitely got his head down, didn't he?
But yeah, and that was basically Stewart's main point, is that, you know what, guys are running it close to the tolerance that they've been given, close to that, what I can't remember what phrase he used, the threshold. They're running it close.
And of course they would. And whatever that threshold is.
That's racing you're going to. There are teams that would and have been caught out in GPs that have gone deliberately underneath because it does aid traction. But in this case, if the guys are running close to the threshold, and unfortunately that, you know, even just taking the valve cap off can release a little bit of air. And if they're checking that and then they take the reading, it's below the threshold, even though when they set off for the sighting lap, it was on the threshold. So they were legal when they left. Taking that valve cap off can drop it below the threshold, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, everybody in my mind knows where the limit is. And
it's racing. You're always going to push to the edge of what you can do. You know, and they are random checks, and some will pass, some will fail, because you're going to get close to it. But all the teams agreed at the start of the season that this would be the way. This is the procedure if there are tyres found to be below the threshold. So, as Hickey said, you know, it is what it is. The tyre was under the threshold, and they took it off into pit lane. They inflated it to the correct threshold, which probably needed a bit of a puff of wind, and that was it. They weren't massively under. It was just literally, it was minimal. But it was under the threshold. To rules is rules. It's a bit like the jump start for Cal Crutchlow, isn't it? He didn't really gain any advantage, but he moved.
A bit of a draconian
it's
penalty.
It's just that. But so setting them off at the back of the grid, Claudio Corti at the back of the grid, Peter Hickman at the back of the grid, made for a really interesting race for Pete. Claudio Corti didn't quite make the same progress that Pete did. He only made it as far as 21st place at the end of the 18 laps, But I thought Hickey's run was tremendous. He'd made it up to 13th place by lap 13.
It was pretty impressive. I mean, he was banging in some fairly consistent laps. But I think it was clear, too, that, you know, even if he had started in place, he didn't have the pace to go with Josh Brooks. You know, looking down the timesheets, I think Pete's fastest lap was a 135.5. Josh managed to put in a 134.6, well, 134.7. So Josh clearly just had the better pace.
Yeah, I mean, Hickey was faster than Ryan Vickers and Andy Irwin ahead of him, but he was equal to Keith Farmer in eighth place. So he wouldn't really have got much further than that, because the guys ahead of him were you know, quite a bit faster. So, you know, the best he could have hoped for on that run would have been eighth place. He was on the tail of Ryan Vickers and Andy Irwin, but he just couldn't, you know, that. Andy Irwin and Ryan Vickers were split by 0.09 of a second, and Hickey was only 0.2 behind them. So another lap, and he maybe could have had a bit of fun with them. But, you know, it was still a cracking run, and it's given him a real push for the season. When the Superbike engine comes along and they're able to use that engine to its fullest extent, I think the chassis is in the window looking at the pace he could run. He was as smooth as you like, and he could put that. It seemed that he could put that BMW exactly where he wanted it, but he's just lacking that little bit of grunt, that little bit of extra horsepower that he needed. I know we said earlier on that horsepower isn't much of an issue, but you could always do with a little bit more. The engine isn't working how it should be.
Who doesn't want more?
Exactly, who doesn't want more? That's exactly right. So.
But we also saw, I think we saw too with the track, I mean, Josh Brooks and Tommy Bridewell in some respects were a kind of a perfect example of that. It can be tricky to pass. And, you know, the Ducatis in some respects, two very similar bikes, although we did find out that the PBM have got the Gucci swing arm.
They have.
Now that the Ducati Oxford Racing, Oxford Products Racing?
Yes.
Oxford Racing
Oxford Products,
Products
Moto Rapido Ducati.
That one. are busily saving up for.
It's expensive kit, isn't it?
It's funny, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, running these Ducatis clearly is just a different price point. You know, you hear kind of Wilf piecing together that Ducati that got trashed at Silverstone. You heard some of the numbers, and then even he's blanching at what Ducati factory is asking for the Gucci swing around. But I think we saw that, you know, Josh was definitely quick in, you know, maybe the first half of the track, and Tommy seemed to pull it back in the second half of the track. It was one of those things. It wasn't necessarily a really exciting race, but there was always this kind of like this possibility that at some point Tommy could use that extra pace and find a way through. But he could never quite line a Josh up. I think he just always seemed to be just that good enough on the brakes and good enough out the corners.
Yeah, it was they were quite evenly matched, but just Josh had that little bit extra. Just to keep himself tickled ahead of Tommy Bridwell, so yeah, it was two not the most exciting races that you would have hoped for, but from looking at the stories further down, I think they made up for it in more than the sense of good racing, and I think that's one thing that the British Superbike fans can do. They can see the stories elsewhere. You know, as you said about Xavi Forres down in 17th place, which is a difficult time for him. Glenn Irwin, 22nd. Even with a fairly low attrition rate in race two, James Ellison, double DNF. He's pointless for the season so far. But the two OMG boys, after such a stellar performance at Silverstone a couple of weeks prior, they had a really, really difficult weekend at Alton Park. They had a difficult test. The bikes didn't quite get into the window. Luke suffering a DNF in the first race, Josh finishing, I think, 10th in race one, 15th in race two. He suffered with chatter and vibrations. It wasn't their weekend. It's bike racing, typical of ups and downs. One week you're at the sharp end, the next week you're sort of hunting for the setup that'll get you around Alton Park the quickest way possible.
Well, I think it was clear the Suzukis just didn't seem to suit Alton Park. I think no. Bradley Ray was the top Suzuki finisher in 12th.
He was 23
Luke
seconds
and Josh
back.
Were together pretty much running exactly the same times. I think they'd squeezed everything they could out of the package for that weekend.
Agreed. And Ryan Vickers backing up his first race in 10th place, the two top 10s for him. Andrew Irwin flying the flag for Honda Racing. I think that's a good result for him and his confidence. But when you look at the times, he's still 20 seconds back. And over 18 laps, that's more than a second a lap.
It was, like you say, it was Josh Brooks and Tommy Bridwell who could go together. Danny Buchan was kind of there in third, a little bit lonely. And then there was like another sort of a bunch. And that was probably where the main interest, I think, for the majority of the race was. The Tyrone McKenzie, Scott Redding, Christian Iden.
Yeah, it's you know, Tyrone tried to make an attack on Scott, but unfortunately it didn't come off. So two solid finishes for Scott Redding. Tyrone obviously had a difficult qualifying session. They had to make up ground in race one. But on a circuit that doesn't really suit him on that bike. It's a physically demanding circuit. He's only a little fella. And it is difficult for him to make too many inroads at Alton Park because of the nature of the circuit. He will make up time, however, at Donington Park in I think, 3 weeks' time, because we've got the Northwest 200 in a couple of weeks.
Less than that. I think it starts 14th is practice for Northwest 200.
What date?
So is that next week, I think.
Oh, sorry. No, it is. It's next week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Practice starts, I think, 14th, and that runs through the week and to race day, which is Saturday the 18th.
A week on Saturday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been on nights and I've just briefly lost where I am. Yes, practice starts the beginning of next week. Race day is Thursday and Saturday next week.
I haven't seen a full entry list, but obviously the news was that John McGuinness will be running the Norton with, I think they've agreed to run a slightly different engine, not the 1200 that they typically run.
They're putting the old Aprilia engine back in.
They're just putting, probably a superbike, a V4 superbike engine.
Which they are doing. They're going to put that... they're going to put that in for that weekend, so that'll be good. Yeah, so all in all, it wasn't such a bad weekend. So Brooks, Bridewell and Buchan, Boss Bumper, Bank Holiday, BSB Bonanza. I was disappointed not to see that headline anywhere.
That was a good one. Can we just have that one more time?
Brooks, Bridewell and Buchan, Boss Bumper, Bank Holiday, BSB Bonanza. Alliteration abound.
And you couldn't even get that up on Paddock Chatter?
No, I didn't even touch that over the weekend. Such a busy weekend. Here, there, and everywhere, and missing out on the GP in Jerez and things that were going on there. It was difficult times to keep topside on social media, at least.
So, looking at those results, then, how does that shake out for the championship standings?
That shakes out for the champion standings that Taran McKenzie leads the way, courtesy of his win in the second place at Silverstone. And a stronger points finish in the second race yesterday. He leads the championship courtesy of that race win. After race one, he had a clear gap. After race two, he now shares the title lead again, but this time with Tommy Bridewell. But he will be top of the standings courtesy of having 8 podium points and a race win. So he and Tommy Bridewell tied on 64. 9 points back is Danny Buchan, and 3 points back from Danny is Josh Elliott. Josh Brooks and Scott Redding, the two PBM Ducatis, make it straight into the top 6 on 50 and 40 points accordingly. So it doesn't take much to get back into the points scrap. Josh Brooks, having a DNF and a DNF at Silverstone, he's now 5th in the standings. The beauty of the showdown system is that you can claw the points back before we get back to Alton Park again in 4 months' time. And it'll line itself up nicely, you know, for the guys that did struggle on that first and maybe the second round. The next round at Donington Park's a triple header. So we have a race on the Saturday afternoon and we have the two races on the Sunday as well. So 75 points up for grabs and a host of podium points as well. Which is a bank holiday weekend, 3 weeks' time, but it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, not the Monday, because that's TT week, TT
exactly,
practice
that's
week.
That's right. We have the that round 3 end of May, and then that heads into the TT break. So some of the riders will be off to the TT, but it'll also give, I'm sure, some of the BSB teams a bit of a time to crunch through what they've learned over the first 3 rounds to come back for round 4.
Certainly.
Brands hats, it just that little bit eager and stronger.
Very much so, very much so. We did pick up a couple of interviews at Alton Park, which I will, obviously I will forward to you. You've not had a chance to listen to them yet.
I'm not, yeah.
We got half an hour with Greg Haynes on where he's been, what he does, and how he became a commentator, and some of his thoughts on British Superbikes and Alton Park as a whole. And that's WHOLE, not as HOLE, because it's a fantastic place. And 10 minutes with the Fireplace Warehouse Motostar rider, American Brandon Pash.
Excellent. I'll add those to the end of the podcast for our listeners to enjoy. So thank you for grabbing that. Thank you for taking the time to be at the event.
Pleasure. Thoroughly enjoyed it. We'll hopefully get a few more chats at Donington Park in a couple of weeks. It's just me. Jennifer can't make that weekend, so I'm just going to do my best to bury myself into Motopod chats. Levi Day will come on the show. The Aprilia Stock 1000 rider. We've got Sean Neary of the Ducati Tri-Options Cup. Sean said he'll happily come on the show if we can get a chat with Phil Spencer from True Heroes. Phil's been on the show a couple of times with the injured servicemen's team. That's always a good listen to what Phil's got to do and where he's at with the team these days and his tie-in with OMG Racing. Lee Jackson said he'll come on. So, yeah, I'm going to try and bury myself in with the Motopod chats because I don't think there's a... that Motostar aren't there. It's British Talent Cup, so I don't envisage being busy doing anything else. So I shall take the dictaphone and see who I can snare while I'm there.
Fantastic. Yeah, looking forward to that. Always like the interviews. It'll be interesting talking to the Aprilia rider as well as a fellow Aprilia rider myself.
Sure.
To hear from him. The only solace I ever take from doing track days on Aprilia is I'm typically always the top Aprilia rider. because I'm pretty much the only Aprilia rider.
Oh, there's two Aprilias in stock 1000 now. You have Levi Day and you have the young Scotsman Lewis Rollo.
Brave souls. I think it's still an excellent bike. Sounds fantastic.
It really does. Yeah, the boys have got the hang of it. I'll ask them about it and also their fairings as well.
Yeah, when they get the fairings. I haven't
forgotten.
Trying to find parts of these things, especially if you keep throwing it up the road, which I have done on occasion. It's kind of hard to do. Fantastic. We've got upcoming races this weekend. I think we have round 5 of World Superbike at Imola in Italy. Obviously, that's pretty much Ducati's sort of home track, so there's going to be a hell of a lot of Ducati support. Even more so, I imagine, this year, given what Alvaro?
That's him.
I can never pronounce it.
Alvaro Bautista.
Exactly. Mr. Bautista, not Dave Bautista.
No.
The other one. Is doing...
That's his brother.
It'll be great to see Chaz and some of the other guys taking the fight to him.
Very much so. Yeah, let's see what comes from Imola this weekend. I can't see much, as you say, much past Alvaro Bautista this weekend, but hopefully Johnny Ray will be a little bit closer to him and maybe try and keep him a little bit honest. And the weather will probably be a little bit better than it was at Alton Park.
I know I've said this before, but I'm still hats off impressed with how strong Haslam has started the season. You know, given all the plaudits and praise that Johnny Ray was, rightfully garnering.
Yeah.
The year before for Liam to drop in to that team and start running him as strong as he had, I think is like really, really impressive, and hats off to Leon this year.
And bear in mind, he has a particularly manky ankle still. He's not 100% fit by any means.
Ugh, is any rider these days?
No, but Leon is the ankle is, I was talking to a good friend of mine on Saturday who knows him well. And he said that the pictures that he's seen it's minging. He said, I don't know how he's doing what he's doing, but he's doing it well. So hopefully the break will have done Leon some good to get healed up and get things back on track a little bit. So yeah, he's been under the radar as far as that's concerned. But yeah, I'm keen to see him push back into sort of top three territory. And also, like I say, keep Johnny honest at the same time.
Dave, thanks very much for giving some of your time this evening. I hope you have a nice, fun weekend lined up and maybe get some time to sit down and watch some of the World Superbikes at Imola.
Certainly will. Always a pleasure. Thank you for having us back on and zoom, zoom to the interviews. This is Dave Neal for Motopod. We're still at the beautiful, leafy Alton Park in the heartland of Cheshire. And... well, we had Steve English on last time, who is the World Feed commentator for World Superbikes. So we thought we'd even it up with the Eurosport World Superbike and British Superbike commentator, Greg Haynes. Greg, welcome to Motopod.
Thank you very much, Dave. I'm already laughing because we were talking earlier on, weren't we, about using the description leafy Alton Park, and you've used it already, so congratulations.
It's part and parcel. I've written enough press releases in my time, and it's almost law that you have to use leafy Cheshire
and stepping into
spring and the undulating track. You know, it's almost cliched. You've been here before?
Yes.
What do you think to the place?
I've been here now. Let's work this out. This must be my third visit, isn't it? Because I've done 17, 18, 19 with Eurosport. I think it's tremendous. It's a funny one, Dave, because I grew up... In fact, my motorsport love, really, in some way, started with the Codemasters Tocker Touring Car games.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And, of course, I used to play all these tracks. And because I moved to Spain when I was 12, I hadn't actually visited a lot of them until 2017 when I joined Eurosport. So it almost feels like you've been here before, doesn't it? Because you've played it, you've seen it on the telly, you've watched bike races, car races. But then you're actually there. It's got that old feeling about it, like most of the British tracks, to be fair. That's what I like about it.
They are mainly traditional. And I've had a similar experience when I went to Barcelona for the GP 3 years ago. You played it on the GP game, you've played it on the car racing games, and it shows how realistic they are.
Yes.
But second round of British Superbikes, you were down there at Silverstone. We're taking things another step forward. It's a little bit different this weekend. Alton Park has different aspects to it more than Silverstone did. Mm. It's more of your traditional circuit. It's a little bit longer. It undulates, as we said. And by the time this goes out, will have had my little gig tomorrow. But we have a little bit of fun tomorrow, don't we? We're actually going to be co-commentators tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about it, honestly, because you know what a lunatic I am putting notes together and folders, super folders, as I call them, and often get a lot of stick for doing so. But, you know, I do. But you've been doing the same thing, and I love we're both as bad as each other, or as good as each other, depending on your point of view. But no, it's going to be good, isn't it? We're going to commentate on the Motorstar race on Sunday. Basically, Neil McKenzie can't make it until Monday, bank holiday Monday, because he's obviously in Jerez doing the Red Bull Rookies, something very close to Neil's heart.
Of course.
But I thought, when our producer Tim Fowden said, who can you think of who might be able to do the commentaries with you for the Ducati tri-options and for the Motorstar classes, we've got Steve Plater doing the tri-options, obviously a former Supersport champion, and he's the ambassador to the series, so that was an obvious one.
Of course.
I thought, what about Dave? Dave knows the Motorstar Championship probably better, and I'm not joking just because you hear him on Motorpod, but probably better than anyone in the paddock. You know, all the inside information. Thought, why don't we ask Dave? And he's a podcast man anyway, so it's not like you're going to be new to the fact that you're wearing headphones and recording and obviously, we're just going out live to a few thousand friends, so no pressure from there. I mean, if you do make a mistake, it's out there. It will be a mistake. Everyone will know.
That's right.
I say, no pressure.
No, honestly,
David, it's going to be good, and I'm excited. How are you feeling about it now?
There isn't any trepidation about it. There's a massive amount of excitement, that's for sure. But there's also quite a bit of nerves. And we're sat here now in front of the console and in front of the TV screens that we'll be sat in front of tomorrow. And it feels really comfortable. I have to say, I know we sat here earlier on and we were speaking to Richard Coventry, the director, back in the truck, and we were getting used to the, especially the UK listeners, if you do follow football as well as motorcycle racing, the handheld microphone with the top lip, John Motson style.
Yeah, the good old Motson and Murray Walker style.
Yeah, and Murray Walker as well, yeah, absolutely. So we had a little play around with that earlier, and there we are on the TV.
That's as if
by magic.
Somebody's in the truck.
You never know that somebody's listening somewhere.
I don't know if people know that, actually. Sorry to cut in.
No, go in.
You may often see that Jack Burnicle and James Whittam are shown on in the commentary box briefly. Yeah. That's obviously a camera positioned in the commentary box, but that is being shown in the truck all through the day. So you can't do anything untoward. Not that you would do anything untoward. But anything you do that may be anywhere near untoward.
I don't even want to touch anything.
Just don't start stealing the microphones and stuff, Dave, because it's all being filmed. But the main reason is when the director's talking to you. And we've been talking about that today, haven't we? The fact you're going to have someone in your ear, not constantly, but often through the broadcast. Sometimes you can just give them a thumbs up if you've got a camera. And it does make a big difference. You don't have to key through and, you know, with OK or whatever. If you give them a thumbs up, they can see you.
But the visual cues absolutely must be so much easier than maybe pressing the wrong button on the console that you have.
Or which I've done before as well. I mean, that's easily done. Is the main thing you have to do on that one is... I mean, there have been some cases in the past where there have been, let's say, an in-joke on the lazy talkback, as it's called.
Yeah.
And people don't switch their mics off first. Depending on the panel you're using, sometimes you have to switch off your mic before you key through to the truck.
Okay.
In our case, we can just press the truck button and it switches the mic off.
Yes. That has a cutout on it.
Exactly. There's an automatic cutout. There have been cases in the past, though, where things have gone out on air. Or, you know, another thing that's easy to do if you're not careful is answer the director or the producer. They might say something. And you hear people going, yes, or no, or whatever. And, of course, they're going out on air, and the viewers are thinking, what's he talking about, and who's he talking to? But it's all part of the fun, really. It's like it's the good old cliche of the duck, isn't it? There's a lot going on below the surface.
Absolutely.
But it's hopefully, I hope, nice and smooth and calm most of the time. Well, that's probably wishful thinking, but you know what I mean. On the surface.
That's going to be me tomorrow. It really is. I have every chance that I have a nice, calm exterior, but a ridiculous amount of nerves underneath.
That's good, I think, though, Dave, because it means you do care about it, because if you didn't, you wouldn't be nervous. That's a good thing. And you can use that nervous excitement in the broadcast itself, you know. Sometimes I get nervous still, not as nervous as I did when I started, but... Naturally, sometimes if there's an important race coming up, or you know it's raining or something dramatic could happen, I find sometimes one of the ways to cure it is to actually just tell people you are nervous. You know, my palms are sweating here.
Well, you're only human.
Exactly.
It's a job that you do, and it's a job you do well, but you're still human, so you still have the human feelings.
And accept that you are going to make mistakes at times, because as you say, we're only human, but as long as you do your prep and you've got your notes, you know, if you make a small mistake, it's going to happen at some point. If you've not done your prep and your research and then you cock it up, well, then you're thinking, well, I could have probably done a better job there. You know, it comes with experience, I suppose.
It does. And when we had the chat earlier in the week about this, about covering the MotoStar race for the Sunday, and I thought, right, what I need to do is start prepping the notes. And I'd seen your super folders on social media before. They're legends as much as anything
else.
Surely
before you unfollowed me.
And, you know, just for one race, this is something for the listeners to understand.
Yeah.
Just to cover one 20-minute MotoStar race, 4 hours of note-taking. And I still think I could have taken more.
Yeah.
There's still something now. Oh, I wish I'd have thought of that. Or why didn't I think of that? It doesn't matter too much to me in the sense that you're driving it. Mm. You need to know all of the numbers, the riders, their background, ages, things like that.
Mm.
That's not my job. That's not mainly what I'm here for. No pressure on you at all. That's your job. I'm here as a jolly. You're here as a job. No, all joking aside, no. But to know, to have those notes ready in case I do need them is better than not having them at all.
You know, the funny thing, you'll probably find, and I might be wrong here, but you'll probably find you don't even use half of them.
No.
But it doesn't matter because it gives you, and I think you're the same as me in this point of view, from a journalistic point of view, it just gives you that sense of relief, I guess, deep down, that you know they're there. You can't possibly cover everything because in a class like this, there's riders changing all the time.
Yeah.
We try and keep on top of what's happened in practice, don't we? Of course, the practice sessions aren't streamed or anything like that, but we talk to people, you hear gossip around the paddock. You can't know every single detail of every single rider and every single
team. It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible.
But at least if you do the main prep, you've got your basis there, haven't you? And you can fall back on that.
We know who are going to be the front runners tomorrow because that's come out in FP2 this afternoon. And we've also been to see Brandon Pash this afternoon.
He's really going for it, isn't it? I mean, let's see what's happened by the time you're all listening to this. But if he does win, if he has won, I won't have been surprised, to be honest, because... No. He's looking very, very aggressive.
And it was our pep talk beforehand. I think so.
I like to think so. Do you know another thing, just to complete that point? The fact we're discussing it so much, I think, is such an important element of it. Now, obviously, it might sound a bit obvious. Of course, the two commentators are going to chat. But there have been times in the past where you might turn up, and I'm working with, let's say, might be James Whittam on one race, James Hayden on another, Neil McKenzie on a third, Paul Napton on the sidecars. And you don't have time always to have a chat with all of them. And the first, and sometimes, and I'm not joking, only time you might see them properly on the weekend is when you are sat next to each other, live on air. The fact we've already discussed a lot beforehand.
Yeah, we have.
We're already on the same wavelength. So if you start saying something about Brandon Pash now, I might be able to add to that, or vice versa. Do you know what I mean? We can link it up that way as well. So I'm looking forward to it. I think you'll also see how quickly it goes by because they fly by these races.
Well, that's all right because the quicker they go, the more you can talk, the less I have to say.
You can screw up whenever you want. Honestly, it's going to be interesting.
How did you start this in the first place? Where did the commentary? Because it's not something you almost leave school and do your GCSEs, A levels, and thinking I'm going to be a sports commentator.
Yeah.
Where did that all start?
When I was very young, I actually wanted to be a doctor. Anyone ever said, Greg, what do you want to be when you're older, when you grow up? Well, they still ask me, what do you want to be when you grow up? No, but I always used to say, doctor.
Dr. Haynes, that's quite a ring
to it. Dr. Haynes. Yeah, maybe you could call me Dr. Haynes in the commentary.
Dr. Haynes.
No, better avoid that. But then I realised from when I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9, I cut my finger or something stupid once out in the garden and realised I didn't really like blood. So I thought, this doctor thing probably isn't going to work. But the commentary thing, I used to listen a lot. Well, basically, the journey started. I would play those Toka touring car games. And that was the bug, really. I was bitten by the bug at that point, is what I'm trying to say. Then I started watching the British Touring Car Championship on the TV because I'd started on the games, then started watching it for real, and Formula One. But it started, to be fair, with cars and with touring cars, not with bikes. And from that point, I used to obviously listen a lot to the commentary, one of which, of course, was Murray Walker still on Formula One with Martin Brundle at that point on ITV. And I just remember finding the enthusiasm so infectious. And I would go out with our little video camera, with my brother, with my dad, and we'd end up... You know what you do when you're out in the garden and someone falls over and you go, oh, he's down, or something like that, which is still great to do now. I mean, a great fall like that, you want to say, oh, down he goes, don't you? So that's sort of where it started, doing silly things like that. And then I used to commentate. We used to commentate on each other on the Grand Prix 3 computer game. Anyone who remembers Jeff Cramman's Grand Prix 3 and all the Grand Prix series, there wasn't a split screen mode for two player. You took it in turns.
Right.
So basically, let's say my dad would play first and I'd be watching and my car is operated by the computer. It was quite a weird way to do it, but it was really good at the time. And then I'd take over and his is on the computer and vice versa. So what we tended to do is while we were sat in his office, the one who wasn't playing ended up doing silly comments on the other one sat in the back of the room. And that's sort of how it started. And then I ended up recording when I was 11 years old, my own commentaries on cassette tapes. Another good thing about that game was you could put it on sort of director mode. So you could direct your own race, does here, and commentate at the same time. So I used to do that. And then I started recording them to see what it sounded like. And I sort of knew then from that moment onwards, I want to be a commentator. I was 11 then. I've still got some of those tapes at home.
Something tells me that I've seen one of those on social media somewhere.
You probably have.
Was it?
Yeah, I was going through some home videos.
I'm sure you posted one.
Yeah, about two, 3 years, probably a couple of years ago.
Oh, was it really that long ago? Sorry.
No, when I posted it. Yeah, it was probably about, something like that, I'd say. Yeah, I found a video that I didn't even know existed until I watched it back. I digitalised all the tapes a few years ago over a Christmas, because we were in England for Christmas, live in Spain, but came over to England. I thought, I've got to get these tapes digitalised, because my granddad's on them and he's not with us anymore. And, I thought,
it's important.
Yeah, I need to get them off the VHS, because they're going to deteriorate and go bad. Anyway, in the middle of all that, there's this thing of my brother and I going around the house in Warwickshire where we lived.
Brilliant.
And I'm commentating and I'm saying, two laps to go, one lap to go, Mitchell wins. Mitchell's my brother. Mitchell wins the race. And I was about 7 or 8 then. So actually, I'd forgotten I'd done that. I've always thought it sort of started when I was 11 doing those computer game commentaries.
Yeah.
But looking back, I was actually doing it when I was 7 or 8, wasn't I?
Which is weird, which is really. Quite impressive, really. So you kind of had an idea then. So did that take you then into journalism?
Well, that was another thing then. Because I was in Spain from when I was 12, the traditional route, because, one of the guys I was always thankful to is Ben Edwards, because I've met Ben briefly at a BBC event, but I don't know Ben personally, really. But he was one of the few guys who actually replied to an email, because I started sending him, how can I get involved?
Yeah.
Not asking for a job, but just trying to find out, what do you recommend I do? And I remember Ben Edwards saying, if I were you, I'd try and start as a circuit commentator or go to a karting circuit or, anything like that. Get going on a circuit PA. And then from there, you might start meeting people and TV could come from there. But I couldn't do that because I wasn't living in the UK. I was living in Spain. And obviously, it's in Spanish. There are some English commentaries, but only on big events. But let's say F1, MotoGP, they tend to bring their own commentary team anyway. So it's not like I can just go to the circuit to Catalonia and say, do you mind if I do the MotoGP English commentary?
But that's the Steve Day way of starting, because his dad ran Thundersport. So he had the circuit commentary and the TV,
which is the traditional way, really, to be fair. So how did I get my first TV? Yes, it was when I was 22. Yeah. I knew the people at the Circuit de Catalunya well, and they needed somebody to do an English voiceover for the 24 hours of Barcelona.
Excellent.
So I went and recorded it, and I didn't know at the time that this was going to be used on Motors TV. That was my actual first TV, not live commentary, but voiceover, let's say. And then I got to a situation where I'd been working with an F1 website for 4 years, 2009 through to 2012. And I could tell that was getting towards the end of its lifespan, really. Yeah. And at the end of 2012, I thought, I need a fresh challenge here. And I was stuck. And I ended up doing a silly thing, really, and leaving that job before I'd got another one, which is something I'd always said to myself I would never do. Never leave a job before you've got another one. Because you never know, do you?
No.
Anyway,
it's easier to find a job when you're in a job.
Exactly. But I ended up going into 2013, the first 2 months, without actually having a job. Now, I knew there was a good chance I could get to Dorna, because I'd already spoken with the guys at Dorna and gone and done a test to do some writing for them at Aragon the year before.
Okay.
But until they'd actually said, you've got the job, they'd given me all the signals that I'd had the job, but it wasn't confirmed. And until you know it's confirmed, you can't be sure. Two interviews came along at once after a big wait, the Dorna one and a social media role with the Force India F1 team.
Oh.
That one, though, would have needed me to come back to the UK. I didn't really want to do, because I'm living in Spain. Based at Silverstone, literally just outside the circuit gates. Anyway, to cut a long story short, and I'm already dragging it out a bit, so sorry about that. But I got the Dorna job, and that was for the 2013 season. That was a writing role with a few voiceovers. And it just so happened, and this is where I got lucky, I suppose you could say. Gavin Emmett, who was commentating on the World Food with Nick Harris, went to a wedding on the Saturday of the Catalan Grand Prix in 2014. And my boss at the time, Mikael Morel, said, and it's his 40th birthday today, incidentally, as we record this, so happy birthday to him. But funnily enough, he said, Greg, how do you feel about doing some booth commentary with Nick Harris? Now, obviously, inside, I'm thinking, you know, can a duck swim, that sort of thing. But you don't want to appear like a desperate kid, because no. I wanted to do a good job, so I never wanted to appear like, yes, please, I really want to do that, which I did, but I wanted to do it in the proper way. So I subbed for Gavin on the Saturday of the Catalan Grand Prix. Danny Pedrosa set a new lap record, I remember. But that was only a one-off. I remember coming away day from the circuit on the Saturday night, chatting with Nick. Nick said, "Yeah, Greg, I think you did a really good job." And I thought, well, he's just being nice. But he said, "No, honestly, I think you did a good job. It was your first time." So that was great. And Nick's a great, Nick's a gentleman and a real pro anyway.
Sure is.
He was my mentor. He really was in many ways. Anyway, as that year carried on, it transpired within Dorna that BT Sport was going to be coming in to replace Eurosport, funnily enough, for the year after, and the BBC. BT was in, BBC and Eurosport were out at that point. And anyway, Gavin went to BT, didn't he? And we started to learn over the year that probably the chances are Gavin probably
which
won't be with us.
Which was the start of 2014.
The start of 2014. Yeah. So through 13, Dorna asked me to do a few more events, practice sessions in Aragon and then in Valencia. And then one race in Valencia. So I did the Moto2 race alongside Nick. Originally, they asked to do Moto3. But after a conversation with Nick and Gavin, we decided it was best that Gav did Moto3. Because it only seemed fair, because it was the finale, and you had a three-way fight between Maverick Viñales, who won it, Luis Salom and Alex Rins. And the three of them went into that last race. So it was a bit of a shame at the time. I think, oh, poor Gav, he's done the whole year. It was his last commentary with Dorna that day. Anyway,
it was the right thing to do.
Of course it was. So Gav ended up doing Moto3. I did Moto2 with Nick. The title had already been decided anyway. Paul Espargaró crashed from the lead. He was already the champion. And we ended up having an Aspar 1-2. Nico Tirol won from Jordi Torres. And I remember there was a photo finish for third between Zarco and Corsi. And that was sort of where it all began, really. And then I sort of knew at the time that was a test, really, for me. One of the guys at Dorna actually said, Greg, make sure you do a good job because Manel's listening. Now, Manel Arroyo is the big boss of TV at Dorna, which didn't exactly help the nerves at the time. I thought, blimey, I need to make sure I do a good job now. I remember one of the other guys said, well, don't tell him that now. You should have told him that later. Anyway, it went well enough, obviously, because I did the MotoGP season with Nick the year after. And that's how it sort of started. And now this is already my sixth season of full-time commentary. Superbikes in 15 and then Eurosport in 17. It's my third Eurosport season already. It's I can't believe by. How fast it goes. It's crazy.
What's been your best moment?
Commentary moment. Mm. Ooh. It's really funny you say that, because I was thinking about this interview earlier and I had a feeling you might ask that. And I was thinking, what would I actually say? There's been a few. One of the days I remember, because obviously we're doing the Motorstar race here tomorrow on Sunday. They're very short races, though. They're a very quick broadcast. Yes. You'll find we're literally straight in. Quick hello. How are you, Dave? Blah, blah, blah. Grid graphic comes up. That goes. Championship comes up. That goes. Race starts. Race ends. Highlights. Standings. Championship standings. Goodbye. On a MotoGP weekend or a World Superbike weekend, especially when you're doing the world feed, there are no breaks, basically. You're on all the way through the day, especially MotoGP when you're doing the warm-ups as well. Aragon, for example, in 14, we had a rain delay in the warm-up and it knocked the warm-ups back by an hour.
Right, okay.
So by the time the MotoGP warm-up had finished, we were almost straight into the MotoGP.
Straight into race.
Nick and I were basically flat out for 8 hours that day. I remember coming out and taking my headset off and going back out into daylight later and thinking, crikey, a whole day's gone by. I've not eaten. You just go on adrenaline. But to answer your question, sorry.
No, it's all right.
Sepang 16... Sepang 2016 was a really memorable one because... And I was commentating with Steve English on this one, on the World Feed. And you mentioned Steve before. This is World Superbikes again with Dorna. Nicky Hayden won his race.
Yes.
But we'd also, before that, had a massive delay to the Supersport race with the rain coming down. Then they tried to start it. Then it rained again exactly when they were going to start. Red flag again. I love those moments. For me, they're my favourite moments. When everything's going to pot and going absolutely wrong. And there's chaos behind the scenes. Organisers trying to work out what we're going to do. TV people are rescheduling things. That's our moment in a way, because if it is chaotic, especially on the world feed, You can't stop. You've not got a team of people downstairs like we have at Eurosport. We can go down to Matt or James Whittam or whoever in the pit lane. You can't do that on a World Feed. It's just you, the pictures, and the commentary. So we'd had all that delay. Then Nicky Hayden won. And then in the Supersport race, which came up, whatever it was, 3 hours later than it should have been, Fahmy Karyadin nearly won the race in front of his home crowd. Now, on the grand scheme of things, not a lot of people around the world would have even known about that race. But motorsport-wise, that was massive.
Huge.
The crowd went mad, Dave. It was incredible. And I just remember the emotion of it. You, Ettan Badovini won his first Supersport race, and so far only as well. But you sort of, deep down, you would have liked to see Karyadin win just because of the fact it was at home. The crowd's going mad. I remember that being an emotional day. There's been a few, though. I mean, we had some brilliant MotoGP races. Mugello 2014 with Nick Harris was definitely one of my favourites. I was still new at this point as well, remember. So I'm still getting used to how it all works and feeling more comfortable as the broadcasts go by. But that was Lorenzo versus Marquez. And Marquez had won the first five races, I think it was. I think Mugello was the sixth. And Lorenzo nearly beat him, and Marquez just got him, didn't he, on the line. But they went hammer and toe all the way through that race. And I remember, I'll never forget Nick Harris going, "Oh, wow, 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 they touch again." And it was just pure emotion. I remember looking at Nick and laughing. But those are the best bits. When the time stops outside, the only thing you are focused on is that screen and that race. It's like life stops. And then after,
it's almost like tunnel vision.
Yeah,
in that sense.
Yeah, I know this is going to sound a bit silly, but do you know when riders say, I was in the zone?
Yeah.
That's what it's like.
Okay.
You're so in the zone at that point, you're aware that you're sitting in a commentary box and that, you know, you're not in the race. You're not dreaming you're in the race or something like that. But you're so focused on what's happening and so caught up in the moment.
Yeah.
Nothing else matters. Nothing. And those are the best ones. There's more. I mean, there's a few great ones, but those two that stand out, I would say.
So which then goes on to the flip side of your most embarrassing.
I'm pleased to say, touch wood, and you know what's going to happen now, don't you? Something's going to happen this weekend. By the time this goes out, something ridiculous will have happened.
Yeah,
Andy and I
I'm going to lock this door here.
Okay, can we get out
that
way?
Our side, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm not going to lock it in.
Crystal Bay's automatic lock.
Thank you.
Thanks for that.
This could be the longest motor pod ever.
If we do get locked in. Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, we could
go all through the night.
A 12-hour. Well, it depends how long my battery's lasting. Yeah. Really,
are you all right for battery then?
Oh, I'm all right for battery now. I made sure I put fresh ones in.
Most embarrassing moment ever.
Yeah,
are you going to say?
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Well, it's easier for me to lock it from here than push on the door.
Most embarrassing moment ever. Now, as I say, touch wood. And you can hear me touching the table. There's not been too many. There was a funny one in it wasn't embarrassing as such, it was
That's
just funny.
Right.
CV 2015. And Steve Day and I had commentated together that year. We'd had some good laughs along the way in World Superbikes. And by the end of the year, we knew Steve was going off to do, at the time, Moto2 and Moto3, and
yes.
I was going to carry on in Superbikes, which is what happened. So we had a sort of last parting gift, which was to go and do the CV races together. And I'd done the very first ever Dorna broadcast for a CEV race at the end of the previous season, 14, as a one-off in Portugal. But now we're at the end of 15, and this is Valencia. And I remember there was a great moment into the last corner. We knew something had happened at the end of the Moto2 race. Do you know when you're watching the long shot and they're following the leader over the line, but in the background you can see people running wide and chaos kicking off? Something had happened, so the replay gets played in. It was Stephen Odendaal and Luca Marini.
Okay.
And they sort of touched each other into the last corner, front wheel on rear wheel, and somehow got away with it. Both ran wide, lost a load of places, but they stayed on. And I remember Steve saying, "How on earth do they stay on board?" And I just came out with, and I was talking about the bikes, not the riders, but I just said, "What on earth was going on there? It looks like they were sort of mating there down into the last corner, weren't they? You got the yellow Calyx of Odendaal and the red one of Odendaal, the yellow one of Marini." And then Steve I remember Steve looking at me and saying, "Are you feeling quite all right, Greg? Mating into the last corner?" So anyway, I ran off at that point to go and do the interviews downstairs. I left him to it. There's also been some hilarity. That 15 year, twice, I think, I was in hysterical laughter and we couldn't talk. There was one at Phillip Island in Australia. Anyone who's not... We kept this quiet for a long time just to see if no one noticed, but... Might as well tell people now. If you go back onto the World Superbike website and watch qualifying for World Supersport 2015, the very first day, bear in mind, that Steve and I had worked together, it was a new look Dorna World feed, the first time Dorna had produced the feed. It got taken over from the Italians who did it before. So everyone wants to do a good job. It's got a new look, new commentators, new everything, really. Anyway, our colleague Michael Hill, who I'm sure you know from the World Superbike Paddock Show, has the brightest teeth in the world.
He really does.
We were really getting to know Michael that weekend, and funny things just kept happening. He kept saying funny things, and then... Anyway, we spotted him. There was a long shot of the pit lane in qualifying, in the run-up to qualifying, and we both saw him walking along the pit lane, and Michael walked along on his phone, texting all the time. And this is what he was doing at this moment in the pit lane. Just obviously he's going around chatting to people before the session starts. But Steve and I both spotted him and we both pointed at him together. And then we're laughing. And bear in mind, Steve and I didn't know each other that well at the time. No. So we're getting to know each other. Everyone wants to do a good job, but we're both now in hysterical laughter. And this is a problem because the session's about to start. So Steve's sitting on the left, I'm on the right. I'm looking out the window towards the sea, the Southern Ocean on one side. He's looking up the pit straight on the other side, and every time we looked back at each other, we started laughing again. So we both switched the mics off, and now you've got this terrible silence, which, looking back, isn't as bad as it feels at the time.
Feels longer this side of the microphone than
a lot more.
Yeah,
and don't be afraid to leave a pause in the broadcast for tomorrow, by the way, because it might feel like a long pause, but people can see the pictures. Anyway, at the time, we were just in hysterical laughter. We kept trying to come back in. It went on for about 3 minutes, which doesn't sound much, but it was. There's been a few of those, but that's really? You know, you can't take, you've got to take it seriously and be professional, but you can't take it
we're not robots,
we are only human. And you know the funny thing, people actually like those moments. Look how many people watch clips of Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby on This Morning on YouTube to see them laughing and cracking up. As long as you're not doing it all the time and making a mockery of the whole thing, people actually quite like those moments.
Whit's a prime example. Whit's been in with us just before we started the interview, and he's a prime example. Yeah. He's got such a rounded sense of humour that he's going to say something.
Yeah, and you know it's coming.
He does. You know he's chuckling away to himself. Yeah. But how he doesn't put Jack off his pace is fabulous.
There was a funny one they had at Silverstone 2 weeks ago when, I can't remember who they were talking about, but Jack described somebody as hanging around in the paddock with his shabby friends. And I was sat next to them, because I think I was doing the next race. Or I normally just position myself there anyway, as long as there's enough room.
Yeah.
Where we are here at Alton, it's a bit squishy.
It
but
is. Tight.
Silverstone, we had a big desk, so I just stuck myself on the end. I was making notes of the race as it went on. Anyway, Jack said this thing about someone's shabby friends, and he didn't mean it to sound like that, but he did. And Whit just was killing himself laughing, so for once it was the other way around.
That makes a refreshing change.
Yeah.
So What does the future hold for Gregory Haynes? Where do you go from
like
here?
A job interview.
Yeah, what are your strengths and weaknesses, Greg? Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
I'm a good team player, Dave. I work well under pressure. I work well to deadlines. That's a good question, though. What does the future hold?
Commentary isn't. It doesn't have almost that longevity to it.
Yeah,
unless you're a Murray Walker or a Keith Ewan, it's quite a tight pyramid at the top there.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to put the mockers on you that there's no career path.
No, it's true.
I'm just trying to.
It's true.
What's the future hold for you, mate? Where do you want to go?
I hope you're wrong. But no, you're right. And things, TV is a fickle business.
Yeah.
Things change. There's a lot of backstabbing that goes on generally. Generalisation,
yeah.
And I mean in TV as a whole. Because that's the nice thing at Eurosport. You get to meet a lot of people who are freelance cameramen, things like that. And they work on all sorts of different things, not just sports. We've got Dawn, who works with us at Eurosport, for example, who works at ITN News.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things. But you hear lots of stories from lots of people about how cutthroat it is. Like a lot of industries, I suppose, but TV seems particularly bad. You get a lot of egos as well. To go back to your question, I like to think... I never know for sure. You don't know which broadcasters are going to be hosting what. Things change, deals end. You know, they get renewed and sometimes they don't get renewed. You never know, do you? I just like to think and hope that I'll still be commentating, and let's say in the next 5 years, 10 years, on some sort of motor racing. But I have to say, people have often said to me in the past, though, because they know I liked cars originally, but I've always followed bikes, but I was a passionate Formula One fan, I'm not going to lie.
It's okay. I'll forgive you.
You know, even Murray Walker was a bike man, wasn't he deep down?
He was, because his dad did the Isle of Man TT commentary,
exactly.
Didn't he?
Even though he's known as an F1 man, his first love is bikes. I just hope I'm still commentating on something that moves quickly, ideally bikes or cars, and we'll have to see what the future holds. To actually answer the question, I suppose the answer is I don't know for sure, but I hope I do enough of a good job. Which doesn't always even... That's not always enough anyway, is it?
No.
I mean, let's hope again. Touch wood. let's hope that I do enough of a good job and people are aware of who I am to continue in the industry and see where it takes me, I suppose, is the best answer, which is a bit of a rubbish answer, isn't it, to be honest?
Well, you know, it's just something that occurred to me because it is such an unusual career path.
Yeah.
But what about presenting? You did After the Flag for Dorna.
Yeah.
So you've done the TV work as well. Would that be something that you'd look into more? Or do you prefer to be behind the microphone rather than in front of the camera?
I guess the viewers prefer me to definitely be behind the microphone and not in front of the camera.
I'm the one with the face for radio, not you.
A lot of people have said that to me, but honestly, it's... I do like presenting to camera, actually. I used to do it when I was, again, going back to when I was growing up in Warwickshire. But no, the commentary is my thing, really. I quite like what I do now, commentating on quite a variety of stuff at the moment. Again, touch wood, you never know, but at the moment. And then doing a few odd bits to camera in the middle. So every now and then again, me and Charlie might do a bit of a postcard from World Superbikes. Charlie Hiscott, that is, or James Whittam and I. Yeah. But you're right, I did do After the Flag when we were at MotoGP.com. I started doing that as voiceovers in 2013. Gavin was presenting the programme, Gavin Emmett. And that was a funny one as well, because I didn't even know Gavin. I'd never even met him. But we were on the same show together. So he was throwing to this video voiceover thing that I was doing at the time, which was a bit odd, actually, in its own way, the way it was all edited together and whatever. But anyway, that's how it was. And then he said, here's Greg with his casting his BDI and what's happening behind the scenes this weekend. And that was basically a team of people at Dorna would say, what should we go for, a sort of behind-the-scenes look? And I would voice it. But we'd not even met each other at that point. And then Gavin went to BT, and there was a sort of new look After the Flag the year after with Dylan Gray.
Dylan Gray, yeah.
And me. And we had quite different ways about how we wanted to do that, actually. And that was very much... A lot of those Dorna videos, maybe not so much now, but certainly back then, they're very structured. So they'll start with one thing, then there's a second feature,
yep.
And there's a third, maybe a fourth, and then sign off, which I think works. It does the job, but it's also a bit old-fashioned, a bit boring at times. That was my opinion at the time, anyway. So I think really the way I preferred to do it was how we did the After Hours show. That was me and Steve Day.
Yes.
For World Superbikes, and then Steve English and I for 2015 and 16. And that was literally sort of the two of us, unscripted, in the paddock, who can we find, throw to some interviews, grab some people. And to be honest, the idea on that one came from how Jake Humphrey used to do the F1 forum on BBC, Red Button.
Yeah.
And I just like the idea of grabbing a microphone. Obviously, that was a full OB, a completely different production. We were recording it, we weren't live. I just like the idea of grabbing a mic, going down into the pit lane and paddock at the end of the day and seeing who you can find and answering some of the questions that were unanswered when you went off air. And it just feels... I remember watching as a viewer. And I think that's a key thing as well, having watched as a viewer. I like to think I know what people would like to know at each moment.
Yes, yeah.
Can't always get it right, but most of the time.
No, but you've got to paint it with a broad brush.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the sort of presenting I've done. I've done a little bit of... Obviously, I'm doing ITV as well now here at BSB. The grid walks are fun, actually. Because that's a recorded programme for recorded highlights to go out on a Wednesday. But the grid walk is filmed as live. So if I do trip over something, which hasn't happened yet, there's a first time for everything, or, you know, there's a bit of a funny joke with someone or whatever, we try and keep it all in.
Excellent.
I don't think we've had to cut one so far yet, luckily.
Again, touch that wood, please.
Again.
Thank you.
But no, I like that bit.
In that wood now.
Just before we get to commentate tomorrow. But no, I like that element of the programme because that is the live element.
Yeah.
And then some of the other takes, the opening link or some of the interviews, we can always cut down or do again if necessary, depending on what the producer wants and the length of them. But I think, again, I'm really dragging this out as a commentator does, I guess. But I like being a commentator who also does some presenting as opposed to the other way around. And I also think, I hope, Dave, I could be wrong here, there's a big market for TV presenters.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of commentators out there, but probably fewer than there are presenters. So I hope that might play to my advantage at some point. But I can't just assume. You can never, ever, ever assume you're just going to be able to keep a job, or if a contract changes one day, that you're going to get taken to the next place. Because how many times have you seen, in my opinion, good broadcasters who aren't retained because it might switch channel, or, you know, for whatever reason,
sometimes
they decide
they
to go with someone else
rather than a voice.
Yeah.
Or they want to give it a new look.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly that.
And on a similar note, I remember thinking at one point when I started commentating, because obviously we've got Twitter now as well in this day and age, and you can get a lot of instant reaction. Usually the negative stuff comes on Twitter.
It does.
Thankfully, there's not too much of it, but you're always going to get someone who, for whatever reason, maybe you have made a mistake in the broadcast, or they don't like the sound of your voice. Or
they know best.
Exactly. And there'll always be people who don't like you. There'll always be people who do like you, regardless of what you do or say. So that's great. There's always people who like Greg Haynes. There's people who don't like Greg Haynes. You've got to accept that. If you get that abuse on Twitter, and we've all had it, and they're just having a go but not really giving you a reason, I sort of ignore it. If they say, oh, actually, Greg, you made a mistake there, I'll actually reply and thank them. Again, luckily, it doesn't happen too much, but it does happen sometimes. So at least you can not be an idiot. And for the people, there's people who like you, people who don't, but not be an idiot and cater for the masses by doing a good job if you can.
I think the fact that you're sat here now and we're doing the commentary over the weekend, then you're back out to Imola for Eurosport in a week or so's time. I think you're doing all right so far.
I hope so, and thank you.
Greg Haynes, thank you so much for joining us. I'm looking forward to tomorrow. And by the time the guys listen to the show, by the time the listeners are tuning in, we'll know what's happened, we'll know how it's gone, and whether I've been escorted out of Alton Park and still never to return again.
Or whether Greg Haynes has been had his contract terminated and Dave Neal's in for the rest of the season, which could also happen.
And it usually does.
And it usually does.
Greg, thank you so much, mate. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Good luck.
This is Dave Neal for Motopod, and we're over at Alton Park, as you guys know, this weekend. And what I'm delighted to say is that we've got a gentleman with me who's no stranger to Motopod. The good Lord Scott Bolton has interviewed him over in America, Moto America, the 2017 RC390, 2016, there you go, it's a year out. It's been 3 years. Time flies when you're having fun. Brandon Pash, Fireplace Warehouse KTM rider, welcome back to Motopod.
Thank you. It's been a while, but we're back and better than ever.
Well, we don't particularly have American weather today. It's not the most ideal, but you're here back at a place that you know well, back at a track that you've gone very well at, and you're fastest this afternoon in FP2, so everything's going well so far.
Yeah, so far so good. This is my fourth time here. 2017 came for the first time on stock 6, and this year feeling good on the 2018 KTM from FPW. Just keep building on it, and hopefully by the end of the weekend we can come away with some podiums, if not some wins.
That would be the ideal. Yeah. Speaking of podiums and wins and getting close, you were contesting the Daytona 200 just last month. Just talk us through that, because that was a bit of an exciting weekend for you, even if the result wasn't quite what you wanted.
Yeah, the Daytona 200, I mean, everything went perfect. Like, my team did the very, very best they could. I did the best I could. And, man, the whole weekend it was like qualifying 2 or 3. We popped an engine on the second lap, so I didn't get to put in a fast time. Then the next qualifying, I think I finished like 10th or something, so nobody was really expecting much from me. And I wasn't – I always knew in my head, I was like, okay, in the race we're just going to go to the front. But yeah, it was kind of nice having no pressure before the race. And in the race, I found myself like struggling at the beginning. I was maybe 10th, 8th. And then every couple of laps, I would find myself up one or two spots higher. And came around first pit stop, absolutely perfect. Came out of the first pit stop, and we were in the lead group. It was, I think, 3 or 4 of us still. Just kept staying up there. Just made sure that I was in that lead group. And that was really my tactics the whole race, was just don't lead the thing when I don't have to. Just sit in 4th, 5th, 6th, and just wait and wait and wait. And we had 2 perfect pit stops. After the second pit stop, I was first place, like leading the race by a few seconds. And man, leading the Daytona 200 first try, I mean, coming from 10th on the grid, like, it was a pretty good feeling. And wound up getting caught by Bobby Fong. He rode really well, and I was just tucked in behind him, just waiting for the end of the race, just lining him up for the last lap. And 3 laps to go, somebody fell and caused a red flag, and they decided to restart it after 53 laps with 3 laps to go.
Which doesn't kind of make a lot of sense, really, because it's virtually done.
Yeah, I mean, any other series or organization would have called it, but I mean, it is what it is. Like,
yeah,
cool. We'll do another three laps, but man, it was rough going from second place, 24 seconds ahead of third, to in the end finishing fifth. I just kind of got bullied around at the end there, but it was definitely a good race. And honestly, a lot more people noticed me from getting fifth than just if I would have won the thing outright, probably, or if I would have got second. So it was good, caused a little bit of drama and put my face back in American racing. So it's been a while. I mean, this year we're going to go do a couple Moto America races, and it's been 2 years since I've done a Moto America race. So
what are you going to be doing it on?
Same bike as Daytona, TSE Racing R6 in the Supersport class, Supersport 600.
Ah, excellent. Just thinking about Daytona, what's the circuit like to ride? We see it over here on the TV. We've got no idea what it's like, but just talk us through a lap. What's it like?
Yeah, so Daytona, coming across the start-finish line, you're six gear flat out. Going into turn one, it's blind, and you go from six gear full throttle back to second gear for turn one, and then the infield, it's kind of like a little chicane before the first horseshoe. Kind of tight in the infield, to be honest. The first horseshoe is real tight. Focus on getting a good drive out of there, and there's a nice little left-hand kink halfway through the straightaway before the second horseshoe, and if you're really going for it, you can wind up holding it just about full throttle fourth gear through there before the second horseshoe, which you go back to second again, come out of there short straight before it puts you back out up onto NASCAR 1, onto the banking, second gear corner before there, a left-hander going up onto the banking. It's really important to get a good drive out of there because you're full throttle six gear for like 25 seconds, 26 seconds after that, just up on the banking. And yeah, you're turning on the banking, but it feels like you're going straight. And the whole time you're kind of like turning your head. You're turning your head through the banking, like trying to look ahead, because you can't really see anything except directly in front of you if you just look straight. And by the end of the 53 laps, your neck is not feeling too good. And then you come out of off the banking, off NASCAR 2, straight away, and then there's a chicane coming out of there. There's a left, right, right, left, and then back up onto the banking. That's pretty hard braking, good spot for passing. You go from sixth gear to second, so really got to be careful on the right side of the tire in that chicane, because you're on the left side for so long. So a lot of people tend to crash when you go from left to right into that chicane. Coming out of there, you come back up onto the banking, and you're just sixth gear for almost probably 40 seconds. It's insane.
Full the only throttle. Place you can.
The only place. And you're on the banking, just your neck turned like 190 miles an hour, just, man. It, honestly, that race was insane at the beginning because it's 12 people, full throttle, six gear on 600s, just bumping into each other at 180 miles an hour. It's pretty crazy, but it's a lot of fun for sure. Anybody that is interested in doing it, I would recommend coming and doing it. It's not as easy as it looks. But we got some crazy English fans outside my tent right now.
There's a big stag do going on outside, and there's a guy from Mask, there's a guy dressed as a hot dog. This is Alton Park. It's up in the middle of the UK. It's just south of Manchester. It's just across. In fact, it's halfway between Manchester and Liverpool. So you get a massive amount of stag. Even I've been here on a stag do before. So it's a popular place for it. We haven't quite got the bank holiday weather, but yeah. So if you can hear things in the background, that's the guys giving it what for with a massive crate of Budweiser. So fair play to them. We'll see if we can grab one afterwards. So far as this season with FPW, without speaking out of turn, the championship has to be the priority.
Yeah, I mean, that's for sure one of my main goals for the year is an American's never won a British championship, and that's basically 5 years ago I put that in my head, like, yeah, we're going to do it one day, and this seems like a pretty good year to do it. So, I mean, I don't want to get too ahead of myself. It's only round one and we haven't even done a race yet, but I'd say that we're in a good position to do so. I mean, we have one of the best bikes, one of the best teams, one of the best riders.
Nicely done.
Yeah, I mean, man, the team alone, they almost won the championship last year. And I mean, I just I feel like everything is going well and everybody's enjoying it and having fun, and everybody wants to win on the team, so it makes it easier to do my job when I'm working with people that are just as excited about it as me. So
here's one for you. The rider last season was Storm Stacey.
Yep.
He's a similar build to you.
Yeah.
Do you think the team have taken that experience and they can provide you with what you need for that? Obviously, with Dave, your chief mechanic, the guy said Storm Stacey's got to be a similar build, so maybe they're quite well prepared for your stature.
Yeah, I mean, the team already before the season, they had everything dialed in. Like, I'm quite tall. I'm 6 foot tall, so we have to have the extended rear sets and the longer clip-ons and stuff, and we have the bigger fairings, the bigger seat, everything that a big rider would need, and they were on it before the season started. I think, yeah, them working with Storm last year, he's about almost as tall as me, if not the same size, and that definitely helps. And then I have my mechanics who were with me all season last year, so my data guy, he came from my team last year. He knows exactly how I ride. He knows, like, when I'm feeling good, he can tell just by looking at the data. And my mechanic, Dave, that guy, he's a legend. Just working 24/7, just making sure that everything's prime. So it's good. It's really good. I mean, we have a good situation. And just coming into the year, even my attitude is different. I'm a lot more excited to be racing, knowing that I have the best bike, and well, one of the best bikes, and a good team around me. Just it's so much better when you're happy. Like, you just show up happy. I mean, the past couple of years it's been really rough, so
it is. A happy rider is a fast rider. Yeah,
you typically, a happy rider is a fast rider, and right now I feel really good, and I'm stoked.
Wonderful. We wish you all the best for the rest of the season. We'll catch up later in the year. I think you guys will be at Cadwell, so that'll probably be a good time to see where you are in the standings and how the season's developed, and a couple of Moto America rides as well before then. So if we can catch up then, best of luck for the rest of the season. Brandon Pash, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys, and thanks to the whole FPW Racing team, Arai, Speedy, Luxstar VIP, Big Bird, my trainer, AD, the team owner, Andy, my data guy, and Dave, the mechanic, and everybody else that's helping us out, my mom. And see you guys soon.
That'll do. We'll see how it gets on.